last 100 years, Hartford's gone from being the richest city in the country to the poorest. The city's in crisis, from public education to public safety. The question for Hartford today is, have we reached the bottom? Is Hartford turning around?
Welcome to Hartford 2020, a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. I'm Jay Hughes, Associate Director of Institutional Research and Planning at Trinity College.
And I'm Ivan Kuzik, the Director of the city's Data Center at Trinity College. Stay tuned for an hour exploring the future of Hartford. Judge Raymond Norco presided over Hartford Community Court from its inception in 1998 through 2003. During that time, Norco was a common presence at community meetings. His name became synonymous with both the operation of the court and with efforts to rebuild a sense of community in many of the city's residential neighborhoods. When it was created, the community court was unique in bringing together the judiciary with various human service agencies. In addition to adjudicating the city's minor crimes, the courthouse became a resource for people seeking jobs, medical treatment, and help with substance and chemical abuse issues. Norco, a city resident who began his career in Hartford as a legal aid lawyer, has both defended and judged many people in Hartford. His experience with a diverse range of people, their circumstances, and the criminal justice system provides him with an interesting combination of compassion and skepticism. He is currently assigned to the Superior Court in Manchester. This interview was recorded at Trinity College on June 2, 2003. So anybody that knows Hartford is familiar with you and the community court. You've been in Manchester for about 6 months now. How do you find the change?
The change is not that discernible. It's like being in the same church but a different pew. The suburb, and it is a suburb in some senses, presents a different array of cases than you saw in community court. Community court was a concentration of quality of life cases. In the Manchester court, you have a lot more alcohol. I'm seeing a lot more parents with kids in trouble. And you remember, the way the system works in Connecticut, if it's a real heavy case, such as a murder, it gets shipped into Hartford anyway. So Manchester handles all the less severe felonies and all the other cases in that area. A lot of DWI out there, which I was really surprised over. A lot of people get arrested for driving under the influence. A lot of kids, which one of the contrasts immediately is like the state's attorney's office prosecutes kids for drinking underage there, and they lose their licenses for 150 days, whereas in community court, we gave them 6 hours of community service, an essay, and off they went, never lost their license. So that was pretty shocking to me when I first got there.
So maybe Metro Greater Hartford should put that on its brochure about one of the benefits of moving to Hartford.
Well, one of the benefits of community court is you don't lose your license for 150 days. And, of course, kids look at you like there's no connect. I mean, what? So I'm drinking, so what? Why do I lose my license? But that's not the way the legislators had positioned themselves.
Well, you were there at the beginning with community court.
To be quite specific, they asked me to put it together. I did put it together. I was the sole engineer of the structure. Asked me, and let's see, I opened up November 10th, 98, so Judge Ment asked me in July of 97 to start the building process. There were no rules. I went to New York and looked at New York, but to paraphrase New York is New York is New York, it had very little applicability to Hartford. So we had to start, I had to start from what to enforce, what not to enforce, who to bring in, which players, how to set up the procedure, how to bring the police on board, prosecutors, public defenders. I mean, I always remember the first couple meetings. I mean, there were like close to 18 agencies present with over 50 people, all looking at me like, what are you doing?
Was bringing social services on board into one court something you had to sell to the judiciary?
To be honest, the judiciary said, do it. And I made a decision early on to do it, not ask too many questions. So, no one ever said to me, you got to bring in social services. They just said, build it to make sense. So it made no sense to me without having social services tools available. And, you know, a lot of lucky things happen. Like the head of DSS was a former law student that worked in her office. So I knew Pat Wilson Coker, who's still there, and you know, she immediately contributed to social workers. I had good familiarity with Capital Region Mental Health. I got them to pitch in. The city pitched in social workers, and then I had a nucleus right there.
Was Hartford selected because it was seemed that sort of the cases in Hartford would lend themselves best to having quality of life crimes adjudicated?
No, I think Hartford selected itself. I mean, in the story, and it's true, is that, you know, there was some money in one of the budgets. I think it was the comprehensive community planning money. They had a judicial component. People said, what are we going to do with this effective? Everybody was complaining about quality of life offenses. Certain people said, okay, let's go look at New York. People went down to New York, liked it, came back, talked about it, and said, let's approach judicial. And the easy thing that they had, they brought money. They brought over $1 million with them. So they went into judicial and says, here's what we want. Aaron Ment, then the chief court administrator, said yes. And the tale began.
Now they're setting up other community courts on that model in Connecticut.
Well, let's put it this way. It's all speed reverse these days. The only other one that's been set up is in Waterbury. And that's a partial 2 day a week or only a certain number of clients, a certain number on a truck, and that's it. New Haven was the closest during my 4 years there that came about. But most of the communities demanded a community court without coming up with the money like Hartford did. And as soon as the money issue raised its head, Hartford gave a tremendous amount of contribution to the community court. The city was really out in the front. Most cities talked the talk but didn't want to walk the walk when it came to the money.
Maybe our listeners don't who aren't familiar with the court, maybe they're not really sort of aware of what quality of life crimes are.
Sure, that's easy. If you had to look at quality of life crimes, you want to take something that really affects the community that has, in my opinion, both a legal component and a social services component. People urinating on the sidewalk, prostitution, johns, noise, fighting, you know, without hurting other people. So we sort of looked, I looked at the statute and said, okay, what out of this can we prosecute in community court that we won't go too far? I mean, we didn't want to take, for example, we took interference with the police officer only if it was a non-physical injury interference. So if the guy lied to the cops, they'll charge you with interfering because you resist, hinder, or obstructs. On drugs, we didn't take anything except the first-time possession or second-time possession of marijuana. Any more serious drugs went into the regular mainstream. So if you sat around in a room with 20 people and said, okay, in your neighborhood, what's the problem? You would probably find in most neighborhoods, murder is not the problem because all the forces converge on that. So what is really the problem? And around this area, prostitution was a tremendous problem. In fact, at the beginning, I did not take prostitution because I couldn't get an agreement with my social workers on how to work with prostitutes. One of my positions was that if a prostitute comes in, I usually set an extremely heavy bond knowing that whoever supported them would not post it. Because I felt that they should be cleaned out down in Niantic a couple of months before they come back into the protocol. It took about the social services team about 4 to 6 months to adjust that particular principle, but eventually worked out a protocol. So you look around your neighborhood. I mean, you don't want people, you know, driving around with their radios bouncing in the back seats of their cars at 500 megahertz, basically breaking your windows while you're trying to sleep. That was an easy one. Breaches of peace where, you know, small fights, not domestic. I think they were what I call common sense quality of life crimes that fit the rubric or the category that we selected. You have to be careful because you did not want to invade the prosecution side of the ledger because, you know, the prosecutors would resist if it was too strong of a crime. So you couldn't overreach. You had to grab things that everybody was in agreement was literally the quality of life.
And it sounds like things that most prosecutors really didn't want to go after anyway. I mean, prostitution and possession of marijuana is not the kind of thing that somebody's going to make their career off of.
Well, you see, you got to remember that Connecticut is a baseline court. So everything, you could have a guy come out in the morning in the same cell with a guy spitting on the sidewalk that's committed a heinous murder. So when you analyze from a prosecution standpoint, most of them are what I call jail-bound guys. I mean, their thinkings are jail is the only answer to the structure. So you had to sell them. And in this case, Jimmy Thomas, who's still the state's attorney in Hartford, was very pro. He had the foresight, in my opinion, to see that this was an important way to handle minority crimes. And if you went to GA-14 prior to the community court, what would you find? You would find these crimes all meshed in with the more serious stuff, but what would happen to the quality of life crimes is they just get flipped off. They would fine some person $35, they wouldn't have the money, and it would end up in limbo, basically. So when you're dealing with the prosecutors, they were very – this prosecutor was an easy sell, but I can tell you in Waterbury – we've had a very difficult sell with the prosecutor down there. He wants to prosecute them all. He thinks that the first impression of most prosecutors is that community courts would be soft. In fact, I had a wonderful conversation with one of my marshals today, and he was a cop in Hartford for 30 years, tough guy, and he kept on saying to me, well, didn't you waste your time in community court? And one of the examples I gave him was that the badder they were, the least they wanted to participate in community court because they didn't want the little blue vest and they didn't want to do the community service. So you had to be careful around picking around the prosecutors to make sure that they agreed that all the crimes were together. And then, of course, the feeder trough, which is the police department, you also had to be careful to convince them to stop a drunk that something responsible is going to happen, because there's nothing more frustrating for a policeman than charging someone knowing that they're going to get kicked out. They won't even bother to stop. They'll go on 9/11. They won't stop for some drunk in the middle of the street because knowing that it's going to get flipped out anyway, why waste my time in the paperwork? So I had to convince the other side of the coin, the police departments, that these were worth enforcing and that the community court was as tough or tougher than the regular GA courts that exist.
In a way, I'm distressed to hear that because, I believe that the Dutch or Nevada approach to prostitution makes sense from a public health point of view and that possession of marijuana shouldn't even be a crime. And so one of the reasons I support community courts is precisely because I see it as a decriminalization of some of these things.
And it is. And it's not – in the prostitution case, they're getting a dismissal. Usually they're the toughest cases to crack. I mean, we found that their ages were much higher. They're in the 30s on the average. They all came with full luggage, psychosocial –
Abuse histories.
The profiles that they presented statistically and data-wise were just horrible. Mm-hmm. But you're right. On first-time marijuana users, there's a legitimate question in our society whether they belong in courts at all. I mean, all of us were college kids at one time. I mean, I sit in court every day and deal with what I know is history for me, and I deal with the people in front of me. And I enforce the laws of the state of Connecticut, somewhat reluctantly on some things, but you just have to do what you have to do. Take an example. Another one is that in West Hartford, which was right over the line, if a kid was caught underage drinking and had a false ID, the West Hartford made a decision to charge him with a felony. So here you had some poor kid. You know, we all wanted to drink before we're 21. It does a stupid thing. And didn't hurt anybody, but it's against the law, and the cop would whack him with a felony, and even if the kid wiped it, there's still a felony trail at some point. But I think your perception of community court is the best way to describe it is that if you look at a crime, does it have a social services component? Mm-hmm. Community courts were driven by crimes with social services components. So we could address the social services with the theory, and it worked, that they wouldn't be back if we addressed the social services issue underlying the criminal offense. Now, in criminal courts, it flips that structure, where the criminal conduct drives the answer. And then the best example I can give you is, say, let's take the woman in Texas who killed her 5 children. Now, she had psychiatric overlays. But because of the nature of the crime and the heinousness of the crime, the social services structure becomes a defense in that process. In community court, the social services drives the answer to how you treat the defendant. A lot of people weren't convinced that that's the easy way to go. I mean, a lot of prosecutors would look at me and say, they used to call it baby court or judges. I mean, a lot of judges think that, they don't want to be there. They don't want to do that. That's something that's always been inherently prejudicial within the judicial system. I mean, I was laughing the other day. We had a judges meeting, and one of the judges, who's a good friend, is an ex-director of the New Haven program. And we were both laughing because sometimes we still, even though we're both judges together, you never escape the bounds of being a legal aid lawyer. I mean, it's just like sort of follows you everywhere. All that particular data and thinking had to go into the community court. And how you utilize, how you sold it to the public, how you sold it to the police department, how you basically address the community was very important at all times in that structure.
I think there'd also be an appeal for a certain kind of conservative because of Giuliani's success focusing on quality of life crimes, that this argument that you start, you know, you can't just focus on the big stuff. You have to start with the subway graffiti and that builds up from there.
Yeah, and there's a certain percentage, a certain population within the conservative community that does believe in that. However, my experience of most conservatives, they believe in jail first, and we'll talk about social services later. I mean, the present administration seems to be going that direction very quickly. And even when the administrations changed, the money for community court just went south. The movement, which was very solid and moving very strongly, just died. There's been no real expansion in that area, mostly contraction since the changes of administration.
There's also a contraction in the amount of money that people are going to be getting for community policing projects. In the last 2 weeks, I guess, at the city council, there were demonstrators worried about sort of closing down the community organizers that Hartford has, which were a big part of the networks that helped to support and build a community court. You know, and the Hartford Police has always made sort of, at least in the papers, it known that it has a strong commitment to community policing. But has that culture changed since the community court began?
Actually, I ran to the chief the other day at Spree's of all places in Hartford. There's always been a fight within, let's focus on the police department. Okay, there's always been a fight in the police department over what I call the 9/11 guys. The guys that like the black, they love the M16s, want to grab that bank robber 20 feet away and drill them, okay? It takes a very unique officer to understand and focus on small crimes equal stopping the big crimes. There's never been, since even a community court, adequate funding within the department, adequate number of personnel within the department, in my opinion, to effectively deal with that in a very concentrated form. And whenever there's a budget squeeze, the CSO officers are the first to go. So they face internal conflict within their own department. Sometimes the what I call the 9/11 guys don't agree with the CSO guys, and the CSO guys don't agree with the 9/11 guys. And so, but the CSO guys go first. And if you don't have people out there, literally, I mean, we used to have bikes. Remember the bike guys? They're long gone. The CSO guys, usually, from my perspective as a judge, the test of a real department. If you start moving your CSOs in, then you're going to be a what I call response department, a 9/11 process department, and you're not going to be very proactive.
Hartford has about 125,000 people now. It's almost going to drop off the list as a city, really. Policing 17 square miles with 125,000 people. Do you really need 9/11 guys? I mean, it's not like we're really a national target, but we have a ton of community problems. I mean, is the thrust of policing sort of appropriate to what we have?
Well, the 9/11 response time is really a mantra in most departments. They examine those statistics upways, sideways, crossways. They examine it with two guys. They examine it with 50 guys. I mean, Captain Polino, who I really like, he and I had a discussion about a year ago at one time, and he said that they sort of examined the down department statistics with the best times, and there was very little difference between the 9/11 response times. But 9/11, they have to be prepared because that's the biggest criticism that they have within a police department, I think. If you don't get there after someone calls and they're burglarizing your car, you're not a happy camper. If you're someone, you know, I can have personal experience. My wife got mugged in our driveway once. And, I was beside myself, as you might expect. And, I wanted to see those cops as soon as I could. And I think that's a normal human response. Now, where you balance that in the department, who knows? I mean, the shift changes in Hartford are always been an interesting source of conflict, where a guy goes off at 2 because he doesn't want to put paperwork with him, and the 3 guy comes on and picks up the 2's calls. So you have an hour difference right there. You know, just talking to most of the guys that I know in the department, the 9/11s usually outmuscle the community service officers.
Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, Waterbury. High concentrations of minority and poor people. Stamford seems to be the only really healthy city that we have according to the numbers. Do you feel that because of the conditions in the cities, they have to be policed and then sort of the criminal justice system has to be altered from, you know, sort of the statewide model? I mean, what works in Derby doesn't necessarily work in Hartford.
No, what East Hartford, I mean, when you realize how many little fiefdoms we have, I mean, if you took Dallas and just took the city property, I mean, Dallas property, if you sat it where the capital is, it would be down by outside of New Haven someplace. Imagine all that run by one department. You know, the provincialism of the state in some respects makes it insular and very attractive, but the provincialism of the state also sometimes inhibits more cooperative. I mean, why do you need three different departments with three sets of standards between Hartford, East Hartford, and say Manchester, or Hartford, West Hartford, and East Hartford, or the contiguous towns that are sitting on the Hartford property? You don't. However, try to play with that, and, you know, the capital region government has been talking about cooperation since I was in Hartford in 1975. Krog has always been using that, let's cooperate, let's cooperate.
So you think there should be more state standardization of judicial guidelines and...
Well, judicial, you got to watch yourself when you're there.
Yeah. I was trying to lead you down the path.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of municipal overlaps with small towns and administrative overlaps with small towns. It probably could be consolidated to save money. I mean, that would be heresy in Connecticut, but that's, you just look around you. How does a Philadelphia exist being so massive, run by one department, versus this Connecticut is so bifurcated in relation to all the little departments all around? And, you know, that argument's been going back and forth since the first town was incorporated here. But there's got to be some economies of scales there that would benefit the citizens. I mean, at this day and age, based upon the lack of money coming back from the feds, I mean, we're in desperate shapes, and towns such as Hartford, where they have the brunt of the economically challenged poor, are going to pay the price in more ways than one.
Now, you're unusual for a judge in that you were a legal aid lawyer rather than a prosecutor.
True.
Do you discern that your approach to the law and to justice is different than sort of the majority of judges in the state?
Do I have to give you an honest answer?
Just a comfortable answer.
Might you be more sensitive to the needs of the poor than, say, a corporate lawyer or a trade and some patents lawyer or something like that?
Well, you hope that everybody that comes on the bench can understand, you know, but they're, like in any business, there's guys that should be in arraignment courts, there's guys that should be out public, there should be guys locked in closets writing briefs for the habeas corpus petitions. I mean, we have our own share. And the one good thing about being a legal aid lawyer on the bench is that our numbers are increasing. Since the state of Connecticut began, I was the first legal aid lawyer ever appointed from a program to the bench in 1985. Can you believe that? I mean, that's how it shows you how we didn't use the traditional processes. And I was very lucky on how it happened to me. And it was because of my legal aid background that it happened. The lawyers coming up, there's a lot of lawyers coming in that have legal aid experience that are now starting to filter in the bench. And yes, if you've handled low-income people as your life's profession, you have a different form of identification. I mean, one of my first shocks when I became a judge is I started handling criminals. When the first time I ever sat in 14 in Hartford, I started seeing all my clients. And I'm going, because I was a legal aid lawyer, we never did criminal. I only did civil. I never realized that my clients were filling up the portals of the criminal courts. I mean, that was a shock to me. So it shows you, even when you're a legal aid lawyer, you can be naive. For about my first 3 or 4 years, I had to recuse myself from a lot of my clients being in the criminal court saying, oh, didn't I represent you? I mean, legal aid presents a different perspective of a law. I mean, you see pain and suffering and starvation and lack of education, lack of homes. You see people that are compressed economically, that have no ability to do what you and I do, and we take for granted. I mean, the beauty of legal aid was I never went home with a problem. I always said, whoa, because people would just come before you. And, human pain is very real, and it has economic, and it also has legal implications in a lot of these cases. I mean, people just don't. Some of my clients were just, I used to just shake my head that they're still breathing and still functioning in our world.
Hartford, if you believe the Department of Corrections data, produces about 3,200 inmates a year in state prisons. The top four cities produce almost 50% of the inmates in state prisons. I was wondering if you have any thoughts on why you get these high concentrations
Sure. It's very simple. Whether it's economically challenged people, you're going to have more crime. It has nothing to do with race, color, creed, sex, physical handicap, or religion. It has to do with economics. And you get repetitive crime. You have an interesting sort of perspective that sort of unfolds. I mean, if the kid is in trouble because of school, the odds are, unfortunately, he's probably going to end up in the criminal justice system at some point. When I did Part A, which is the murder court over here in Hartford, I did it in 90 to 92, I think. I was struck by the fact that almost 100% of the serious crimes, they never graduated from high school. They had kids splayed, like 4 and 5 kids with different mothers splayed all over the place, which I knew were in trouble. So it's that the city, and I mean, look at Hartford. I mean, one of the things that always fascinated me about Hartford is that a lot of the suburbs dump their problems off on Hartford. I mean, we at Legal Aid used to sue one of the cities west of the river constantly for giving people $5 to get a bus to go to Hartford to get their social services. We've seen that. A lot of your shelters are filled with people that come from out of town. A lot of your drug buyers come from out of town. I mean, the Nelton Court syndrome, which we experienced in community court, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but one time they raided, they put cops on one end of Nelton and on the other, got everybody on ingress and egress. We had a docket within next 2 days of about 100 people, and it got so funny that I set up a list of 16 reasons why I'm in Nelton Court. I mean, I've lived in this city since 1984, and I couldn't find my way to Nelton Court today if you asked me, but these people were coming from Plainville and all these places finding Nelton Court very simply. And someone, I ran into Cornell Lewis the other day, and he told me that there's a website for Nelton Court with the drug dealers put up. And I said, oh, that's I haven't found it, but that's what the Reverend said. So you have that calamity in some respects of all these desperate entities coming to the city. And then you throw in, I always throw in exempt property as a problem. You throw in the churches, the schools.
State buildings.
And the fact that I talked to the Al Ilg about 2 or 3 months ago, and he says that I think there was like a $40 million difference between the amount that the state paid versus what they would be taxed. That hurts. And, you know, we've got states running. We got every state in the union running around trying to squeeze money out of every thing that they could possibly think of to tax. City like this, every time someone turns around at the General Assembly and manipulates educational give backs and things of that nature, it hurts.
We were just talking to Matt Hennessy about ways to make the city more attractive to small entrepreneurs and ways of keeping taxes down and things like that. And, of course, if we don't address more basic revenue questions, how could we possibly do that?
You know, I don't want to give away my political affiliations, but with no money flowing back from Washington and flowing into pockets down in Greenwich, we're going nowhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, that article that guy wrote from Greenwich was one of the – I thought someone from Saturday Night Live got in there and put it in the editorial in the paper. I mean – if you leave us alone and let us have our money, more people will buy BMWs. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, the whole system is compacting. When you have a state like California with a $38 billion deficit, I mean, Connecticut's deficit looks like child's play compared to that. Mm-hmm. But where do we go? I mean, how far do we tax? I think the cities pay first because they have, you know, the other thing that cities have, that they have all these agencies telling them what to do that cost money. And no one's saying, oh, yeah, we'll pay you for that. It's an interesting vortex, that money flowing into Washington that doesn't flow back in a stream to a state or to a city presents all sorts of complications in our society. Did Mr. Hennessy give you an answer?
Not well, yes.
Well, we were working on it.
Yeah, you can listen to it on the show.
All right. At least he was optimistic.
I'm working on it.
You're listening to Hartford 2020 on WRTC, the radio station of Trinity College. Hartford 2020 is a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. Guests include former city manager Al Ilg, Councilwoman Elizabeth Horton Scheff, former Deputy Mayor and mayoral candidate Bob Ludkin, Judge Raymond Norco, and labor leader Ed Vargas. Hartford 2020 is a joint project of Trinity College's Cities Data Center, the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, and WRTC. Your hosts are me, Jay Hughes, Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Planning Office, and Ivan Kuzik, Director of the Cities Data Center. For more information about upcoming shows or to listen to shows on the web, visit Hartford 2020's webpage at www.trincol.edu, that's T-R-I-N-C-O-L-L, /departments/DPTS/IRP/, or call 860-297-2112, or email us at james.hughes, that's james.hughes, at trincol.edu, trincol.edu. Now we return to our interview with Judge Raymond Norco.
If we could just go back to the community court period.
Sure.
In the time sort of I was involved with the court and with TCN and the CCPs, You were a pretty constant presence at a lot of neighborhood meetings. You had a really good interaction sort of with the block groups and other groups in every neighborhood. How important were they?
Very. Extremely. I love that. I mean, I always remember one incident. I'm over at St. Augustine's, and this little Italian woman sort of walks up to me and starts talking to me about community court and talking about community service. And I said to myself, now that's interesting, because here was a citizen, probably in her 80s, knew about community service, knew what they did, knew how they did it, when they went out, what they were doing. I found that fascinating. Now, community, I was tired when I went to these meetings, but I always enjoyed the meetings because they wanted success for the community court. And as long as they were in that mode, they almost guaranteed success in some ways, because there's pressure, and then there's implied pressure, and then there's subtle pressure. And when a community says to you that your institution's working, we like what you do, it sort of, you know, fueled me. It fueled the police, I think, because I've been to meetings where the cops just come out. You know, in fact, the same St. Augustine's meeting, I always remember that because there was someone playing loud music. Lieutenant Manzi went in and warned the guy. Guy flipped the dial back up when he was 20 feet away. And the woman was hollering at him, why didn't you arrest him the first time? And I said to myself at that point, you know, the standards are impossible to meet. But these local meetings were interesting dynamics. You had your characters. You had your people always had to say something. But you had a lot of citizens giving everyone that was associated with the structure positive feedback, which I think made their jobs easier and made them do it better. I enjoyed all those meetings. I don't miss the time, but I enjoyed going to those meetings. And people were always nice to me. I mean, you know, they crank at you every once in a while, but that's part of the job. I like to hear from people, and I love to laugh with them because, you know, they found humor in it. They found, you know, Mr. Softy when that blew open. I mean, I had colleagues sort of jumping on my tail saying, you know, I'm writing Supreme Court decisions and you're screwing around with an ice cream truck.
Tell us about Mr. Softy.
Well, that made CNN. This is a good story. This is one of your favorites.
Oh, yeah.
The crime-ridden Southwest neighborhood, I think, was responsible for.
Well, the what I tell about people about Mr. Softy is that, listen, I ended up in Parade magazine on the same page as Spider-Man and Martha Stewart. I mean, what better company could you have in this world? I mean, I should have retired at that particular point. I made my day. But no, Mr. Softy was, I mean, you talk about human dimensions, about a very simple problem. There it was. I mean, we have assaulted behavior. We have cast of characters. We have people weighing in. I mean, it was democracy. I mean, that's what I thought. I loved it.
What's the thumbnail version? What happened there?
Police stopped the Mr. Softy truck because of the noise level. So half the citizens said, it's an ice cream truck. What are you doing? Leave them alone. The other half said that the noise levels are too high. They're out too late. And the other thing that was really a kicker in the thing was the Italian word passacaglia, where they play the same thing over and over again. So the repetition of the Mr. Softy jingle drove them crazy. So I had a ton of people telling me, you know, melt the truck, do what you have to do to stop this. And the other half saying, get your hands out of there. What are you doing? You're playing with an American tradition. And
So you did had a Solomonic decision, basically. I mean, limited them to the amount of times they could ring the bell on a certain block, right?
Right. I mean, I put them in – well, one of the beauties in the picture in the Parade magazine reflects it is I had them set up the two trucks, and I said, I'm going to listen. And so I just made them put up at a certain decibel, walked away, got both parties. Is that agreeable? Is that – and we worked out a decibel level, which they agreed to keep. We worked out a repetition letter level, which they agreed to keep. Of course, it's traditional in the American sense of justice. What happens is that I'm in after I get all this agreement. I write this the decision, which I quote Voltaire. I mean, the theme that I walked around all of that summer was that ice cream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream. I mean, couldn't get it out of my brain for days. But after I get finished with this decision and everybody's in agreement, one day I'm sitting in chambers and I'm reading the ordinance. And then all of a sudden it dawns on me that this is not validly enacted. So I call over to Corp's office and I say, hey guys, before you enact the disordinance, did you check with the DEP? No. Then I had to tell them, sorry, not enforceable. So then we had that period where all H broke loose because it wasn't enforceable. So not only do we have this summer of playing around with it, but then at the end we had to spike it. And for some reason this summer it's died. I haven't heard anybody mention it in any way. So I don't know. Maybe they're – I see the attorney that represented the ice cream guys in Manchester, and I scream at him every once in a while. So maybe presumably he's following the rules still.
Well, I understand it was the Mr. Softee controversy that actually got you moved to Manchester. Any proof to that rumor?
No. I think the merging of the GA-16 into the – into the community court got me moved to Manchester in one form or another.
There was a lot of screaming and gnashing over that, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were. I mean, people took hard positions on that, and the positions were understandable, but when they addressed my bosses, they got a little, let's say, carried away a little, and I knew I was meat. It was just a question of when. But, no, I mean, their position was that it was working, and they wanted to keep the purity, and they did not want the community, the suburban cases in. And quite frankly, I opposed that position because I knew the community court, the suburban cases would make a difference and they would not upset the functioning of the community court. In fact, when I still get the statistics, I look at the stats, it's a good thing that the suburban cases are mixed in there or there would be a different function for community court, I think. But, you know, honest citizens have different positions and they played their cards and, you know, the natural consequences of what happened happened. No regrets. I mean, the best meeting I've ever been to in my life was probably the worst meeting for my boss was when they confronted him over at St. Francis Hospital. I'll always remember that meeting as long as I live. And citizens very forcefully stated their position. And, you know, on one hand, I had to love them for stating the position because it worked and they wanted it pure. On the other hand, it wasn't a good position to be in.
So you live in Hartford.
Yes.
That was one of the things everybody really liked about Ray Norco.
Right.
I mean, you know, the fact that you were a resident.
Still am.
Why are you? I mean, you know, even the mayor moved out for a while in the 80s.
I said mayor lives around the corner from me. We came in 84. We live in the West End. And it's a wonderful neighborhood where people care for each other. They look out for each other. Our street has two parties a year at different neighbor's house. We're fully integrated. People look out for each other's interests. There's always someone around during the day. It's a wonderful neighborhood. It's the best neighborhood I've ever lived in. And the people, once they get to know each other, usually, I don't care if they're living in Timbuktu, can make it work. I love this city. I think it's a very beautiful city. I shudder every time I drive around and see trash, which, of course, if you saw the letter to the editor today, she was comparing, when they were doing the comparison between Providence and here, they showed a picture of Cianci on the river and it was all clean and functional. They showed a picture of Eddie walking down Park Street and there's filth all over the place. And they were saying that that's one of the problems with Hartford.
There's still litter after the community court send its work crews out.
Well, you know that I used to drive down streets and call it in.
I do know that.
I used to call in and say, Chris, get out there and get on that street tomorrow. I mean, that was one of the beauties I loved about coming in. I mean, I had my, used to come in the West End and by Mr. Tuxedo over there, there used to be these four islands and I made sure that they were clean every 2 weeks or so because they looked terrible on my way to work. I mean, that was one of the lucky things I had about it. We did five full streets. They still do, I understand, in Hartford every Monday. I sent all my crews to these designated streets to help the city along. Hartford, I mean, just look at the Katharine Hepburn, situation, and then she's going to be buried in Cedar Hill. Murder. I'm wrong. Can't get out of the business here. She's going to be buried in Cedar Hill. If you've ever been over to that cemetery, that's a gorgeous cemetery.
Yeah,
I mean, this institution, I love this institution. I think this is one of the diamonds in Hartford, and they don't play it up enough. And I've said that to Ilg when I see them every time. I mean, integrate Trinity greater into the city's profile. I mean, one of the things I get mad at is that all the signs around here don't read the capital city. I think we sometimes, the general public underestimates the city as a city as being the capital. And it's a beautiful little city. I mean, one of the things that I used to have in community court that I loved is I had visitors from all over the world. And I was always struck by them telling me how clean the city was. I was always fascinated by that. And I used to say to myself, where are they walking? But in most cases, I mean...
They probably came through New York.
That's probably true. Yeah. They had some contrast. But it's a viable, lively city. It has arts. It has museums. It has space. You know, Elizabeth Park is just, you know, why would you want to go anyplace else? That's like a gem in the bushes there.
You mentioned Trinity College. You used to bump into Trinity College kids every once in a while at the court, right?
Oh, yes.
They used to write the best essays, right?
Yes. They wrote the best of the most. I mean, they had the mean as far as best. I could tell the difference after reading probably about 280 of them. I could tell the difference between a Trinity essay, a Bloomfield Avenue School essay, and actually the best essays I ever had were from a little school up the road here, I can't even think of the name of it, in Windsor, the little private school there.
Loomis,
yeah. I had a couple essays from kids from Loomis that were, I mean, and you know, that was, we used to call them the shiny kids because we could always tell when there was a raid and the college kids got nailed because there they would be. And the younger they were, the more relatives they would have. So if they were Loomis kids, their grandparents would be there too. If they were just Trinity kids, never brought their parents, but I always made sure that their parents knew. That was one of my devilish little tricks. But yes, there was a tremendous difference between the two schools. Trinity kids, to be quite blunt, would understand the relationship of the structure, how they failed themselves, their parents, the responsibility to life, vow to never do it again. Other essays would say that I'm missing school, how dare they didn't renew my Miranda rights, and I miss my nail appointment, how dare they, I'm not a criminal, and I should be in school today rather than doing community service type things. There were exceptions, obviously.
Now that you've been out of community court for a while, looking back, what do you think the biggest impact was on the city? From starting the court and really leading it through its first 3 years of development.
And I hope it's perpetual. I mean, I think that we sort of, the real practical effect is that it processed crimes that normally would be ignored, recognized them as having penalties, such as noise, such as loitering, such as drinking in public. It brought the public's awareness, and you've proven statistically that the higher enforcement of quality of life cases, the less cases, you had a direct correlation dropping of serious cases being lodged in the other court. And the other thing, to be blunt, is we picked up about 18 tons of garbage. I mean, we had our own spot at the dump. My crew every afternoon would drop off, and if it was too big, they'd call in and the city would cooperate and pick up what we couldn't take. I always chuckled that I want to take all that we picked up and drop it into the state house and see what it looked like. It would be pretty big. And, you know, the crews are very effective. A lot of streets are what I call 9999s, which are we do them as soon as we finish. But I think that was a milestone. I think the cooperativeness between all the departments was unique. The fact that you had citizens of the city happy with the enforcement structures of the CSOs in relation to the quality of life. The prostitution issue around here dropped immensely. I mean, one of the examples I used there, it used to be signs up here, if you pick up a prostitute, we'll take your car. I knew we sort of hit a good streak when someone called me up and asked me to get the signs removed because it was embarrassing because there's no longer any prostitutes around. I thought that was interesting.
The prostitution issue, you became the only court in town really dealing with that.
Yes.
So you probably, and the prostitution protocol was quite unusual in that every woman that was arrested had to go through the protocol?
No. Those with multiples, I mean, 15, 20 arrests. We excluded those that we didn't think we'd be wasting our time, basically. The ones that were in first or second structures that had the ability to relate to the protocol was the ones we selected and tried to keep out of the systems again.
Thanks so much for joining us.
You've been listening to an interview with Judge Raymond Norco, who presided at the Hartford Community Court. Stay tuned for an interview with Selwyn Cruz, an alcohol and drug counselor with the AMIR program in Hartford.
Selwyn Cruz currently works with AMIR, African Men in Recovery. AMIR is a collaborative between Hartford Behavioral Health, the State Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, Community Health Services, and the Urban League. AMIR provides clinical outreach and outpatient substance abuse treatment for African American men who are either intravenous drug users or face greater risk of HIV and AIDS infection. Selwyn, who's formerly from South Florida, oversees Teen AMIR, a project intended to educate minority youth about the risks and alternatives to drug abuse and addiction.
Selwyn, can you tell the listeners about African Men in Recovery?
The AMIR program is a recovery program set up for black men in this community. It's African Men in Recovery. It's a recovery program that's basically set up to encompass black men who historically have been failing at achieving and sustaining recovery due to the old recovery model.
Can you explain that a bit?
In the past, most recovery-based programs, recovery programs, were set up to service a traditional white middle-class male. That didn't necessarily work when it came to a black or Hispanic male. The AMIR program is centered right in the community where these individuals live. The same man that I see to counsel who walks out of my office and goes home must pass by his local drug dealer and two or three liquor stores to get home. And, you know, as he recovers, that challenge of staying abstinent doesn't change. The demographics doesn't change. Mm-hmm. He's got to still make it from my office or from his job past two drug dealers or two liquor stores to get home. And his old way of behavior has been to, well, I can walk that same road. I can willpower it through. And that's failed him. The other recovery programs haven't necessarily been able to address the fact that that dealer is in front of him.
And how does AMIR?
AMIR allows him a face to actually meet on the street. The same, we have 94 men in this program that are recovering, and we're into our third year. And these men support each other. If you got to travel the same road, that liquor store hasn't moved, and that set of dealers haven't moved, so we give you the option of walking around the block, you know, and using it as a reality. You don't go that route if you're still weak enough to be tempted by the door, the front door. A lot of the men that we see, they travel in the same circles, they attend the same churches, they go to the same barbershops, you know, they shop at the same grocery stores. And
so is part of this establishing or helping to establish a new social network for these men?
Absolutely. We introduce these men to positive images that they would not have been exposed to before. Most of them have begun to meet legislators, city officials. It's given them a new beginning, a new outlook. We train them in the social structure as it's always been in front of them, just not utilized by them. We get them registered to vote. We don't tell them who to vote for. We give them a reason to vote.
But they do vote Democratic.
Well, that's entirely up to them. Some of them refuse to even put down a party, you know. And if they've learned to do that, we know that they're clicking. Okay.
All right. Do you use the 12-step model, like the AA model?
The AANACA model is utilized as a support network. Yes. And even though the cultural change from all black men in this room to a 12-step recovery program as a support network works, they still return. We've had three rites of passages, which is a period that these men stay in the program, stay clean, and they continue to come back to the program just to support the man that's coming in the door for the first time. A lot of these men will achieve 6 months to a year, and you ask them why they come back, and they'll come and they'll sit in the same group that they started in order to let the man coming through the door know, you know, listen, I made it, you know, and
Is there something really white about, like, the way AA does it, though? Like, having a bunch of people sit in folding chairs and get up?
The question is.
I mean, are your meetings somehow culturally distinctive in a way that would be more welcoming than a traditional 12-step program?
I'm not putting down the 12-step programs. AA, NA, CA, all are support networks. The 12-step recovery program is a positive. It gives you guidelines in which to formulate a recovery program. Meanwhile, AMIR takes your life, in addition to the 12-step programs, but AMIR takes your life and places it where you can deal with it. You've got men in the room that are going to pull you up on your garbage. You know, if it's a language barrier that's holding you back, guess what? There's a man across the room that will get right on down with you. Everybody doesn't speak as well as I do. Some aren't going to try, you know, because that's been their culture. That's been where they came from.
If you're an African-American man who's economically out of straits in our society and you go into one of these programs, are you saying that they might use that to rationalize why they ended up the way that they did? And if they're in a situation with other men who have a similar kind of background, similar situation, they wouldn't be as easy to get off the hook. They'd be able, you know, they'd say...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Someone's going to pull you up on your short, you know, if you want to rationalize it. And I've watched it myself. Men try to come in week after week and rehash the same old thing. Well, it takes an inner change. And if you don't change yourself, you know, your way of thinking, and you're going to stay in the mold that you're in, yes, you're going to stay susceptible to the same revolving door. You continue to go out there and stand on the corner and juggle drugs or try to smoke on the weekend, or, you know, and then you can't pass a drug test at the end of the, you know, first time your boss says, well, you look a little funny, or we haven't, you know, your name came up on the computer. This particular program puts enough things in your way for you to utilize them.
How do you find men who are looking for this help?
A lot of it comes by word of mouth. We flood the neighborhoods with flyers. Most of the men in this program are quick to reach out to another brother that they know, that they used to get high with, that they used to get drunk with, that they used to work with, and say to him, listen, I found something that works. Okay, my own personal recovery story, and I'm not from this area, I come out of South Florida, is a lot like that. I met Harry at a shelter. At a soup kitchen. And he said to me, get in the car. Let me introduce you to AMIR. And I came in and I sat down with these men and I was like, wow, you know, everything in here is black. And everything in here sounds just like me. And everything in here is my story. Some of it is not as bad. Some of it's worse, you know, but it all is real familiar.
Black communities in the United States have strong sort of networks, often based in churches. Have the black churches in Hartford been supportive of this? And I understand black. There's a wide range. Mm-hmm. So I imagine, you know, it's easy to say some are, some aren't. But I'm wondering whether there are existing social networks that you find, you know, are natural allies and partners and collaborators in this work.
They're beginning to be, because this has never been done before. No one on any scale, under any circumstances, has done what AMIR has done. We are the number one recovery program for the state of Connecticut. We've been recognized by the state as the largest model and the model for any recovery program. There is no church organization that I know of that has been able to accomplish this just by saying, well, we're, you know, God-fearing and, you know, this is going to work. I think that a lot of what happens from this point on as far as spirituality goes, is that these churches will begin to address 12-step programs differently, because now black men are going to start to service their community, and they're going to do it in their churches, and they're going to do it in the schools, and they're going to do it in their communities. This is not going to be a one-time, one-shot deal. This is going to be a continuation of growth. That program has allowed me an opportunity to start a Teen Amir, which I currently have running. I have a summer program and the Teen Amir program. And if I can take a minute, I'll talk about it. The Teen Amir program came to me as a necessity because I began to engage young black boys that had absolutely no fathers, no brothers. In other words, no male figures in their lives. And that was a scary thought to me. I grew up with a grandfather and an uncle and a black church. And I wanted to say this when you mentioned churches. The black church has always been and will always be the binding glue, if you will, for the black community. I don't care what denomination it is. The children that stay in churches stay bound together. And that was, when I was in the 60s, the way of life. Today, because of the growth of the community and the growth of the world and the times, the growth of media production, and kids get to see so much more than we did, it's going to take the church to bind us back together again. I don't care, you know.
So, you say you're from South Florida. How is life different in a city like Hartford in the Northeast than it is for a black man in South Florida? And are the challenges different? Is the situation different?
I consider, this is personal, I consider Florida the cocaine capital of the world, okay? And I'm recovering from crack cocaine, okay? Economic differences, I believe a black person that moves into this area with any education is going to economically be better off than he will be in South Florida. Florida itself is a tourism state. I love the state. I love the fish. I love the beaches. But it's a tourism state. And there will always be a service industry there. And for a black man with limited education, and the education system is not as available because there's not as much, whether it's the number of schools or the number of economic programs that would aid black men. Or black children, as far as that's concerned. They do a lot. The teen, if I can get back to that Teen Amir, is an opportunity for me to address young black men and boys, because now we're talking about two different areas here, black boys who have, for the last 30 years, three generations, have not had a father or a brother in the household. The number of blacks in this state, fathers and brothers that are locked up, are about half of the total population of the black community. And that's according to the latest polls. Okay. So if we represent 27% of the state, 54% of that is incarcerated for drug offenses and low crime offenses.
Selwyn, will you tell us how people who in Hartford who hear this program and who happen to be African-American men who might need your services, how can they get a hold of you?
They can locate me at Community Health Services. That's 500 Albany Avenue. I work in the Behavior Health Department. Phone number, 808-8789. Our Dorian Parker's number, which is the director of that program, is 808-8797.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hartford 2020 is a weekly program on the problems and opportunities facing the city of Hartford. On this program, you'll hear politicians and community activists, scholars and gadflies, and people from across Hartford's many communities sharing with us their candid opinions about how Hartford reached this point and where it's going. Guests include former city manager Al Ilg, Councilwoman Elizabeth Horton Scheff, former deputy mayor and mayoral candidate Bob Ludkin, Judge Raymond Norco, and labor leader Ed Vargas. Hartford 2020 is a joint project of Trinity College's Cities Data Center, the Office of Institutional Research and Planning, and WRTC. Your hosts are me, Jay Hughes, Associate Director of the Institutional Research and Planning Office, and Ivan Kuzik, Director of the Cities Data Center. For more information about upcoming shows or to listen to shows on the web, visit Hartford 2020's webpage at www.trincoll.edu, that's TRINCOLL/departments/DPTS/IRP/, or call 860-297-2112, or email us at james.hughes, that's james.hughes, at trincoll.edu, TRINCOLL.edu.